Colin Cullis, Business Unusual correspondent, surviving disruption. There's so much focus on disruption and how everybody must go and disrupt themselves and disrupt each other and disrupt themselves into oblivion. There's very little that is spoken about those that survive disruption by doing what they do better and maybe using some of the disruptive technologies to their benefit, but essentially just being better at what they do.
Yeah, the list of people who become, you know, either they go obsolete or become a shadow of themselves, former selves, is a lot longer than those who actually survive. And so rather than just focusing on the disruptors, which sometimes can feel a little bit like, well, that's the end of the world for all of us in regular business. How are we supposed to compete with these guys? I figured let's have a look at two of them. Certainly that did show it was possible to overcome it. And the first one is one certainly a name you would know. It's a 250-year-old publishing company called Encyclopedia Britannica. And while these days you might think, Wikipedia was the one that was probably going to cause trouble for it, they saw the writing on the wall and looked up the entry for obsolescence long before Wikipedia came along in 2001. It was already in the 90s when home personal computers started coming about. And they started seeing a shift that younger people were sort of taken in with these computers, the rise of computer games, and the idea of trying to go and access something via this machine rather than a book was already doing a shift. I've included a little video online from a 2015 YouTube channel that sort of gives a variety of historical, I'll put those in the, you know, sort of air quotes, historical things to teenagers and then ask them what this is. And the video I included today, they gave them a bunch of encyclopedias and they're like, whoa, there's a lot of these things. And when they asked them to try and find something, they actually had to think about, oh, so they're actually listed alphabetically and you've got to find the book with the relevant letter. Then you go in the book and go through the entries to find out what it was. Quite bizarre, and that's 2015 only. But their big win was back in the 90s, they started seeing we have to switch to – we're an educational thing. Let's switch to becoming a resource for educational institutions. So sell the product the way they sold their books to libraries. They would now sell their digitized software to schools. And they started actually distributing it via big companies like Microsoft. You could buy the Encyclopedia Britannica as an online edition when you bought your copy of
Couldn't you buy a disc first? You could buy the CD-ROM of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Didn't they go that way first? Certainly DK did, the publishers.
Yeah, absolutely right, Bruce. They understood that they needed to go digital before they realized they had to go online. And they actually then finally realized, look, there's enough with the real world stuff. I think the final books rolled off the presses in 2010. You don't get the books anymore. Or you do get the books, but they'll be on an auction site online rather than, you know, somebody trying to knock on your door and say, listen, I've got this great investment for your kid's future. And you know what? They have 4,000 editors checking up on over 120,000 researched articles, and you get that for about $1,000 a year. It's not a bad prospect. And you might think, okay, well, so what? There it is. Well, they've recently, the most recent thing in July, they partnered up with YouTube because YouTube has got a lot of people uploading videos, making all sorts of claims about all sorts of crazy things. And YouTube, Google's in no place to try and correct everybody. So they simply asked Encyclopedia Britannica and they put links up to the Britannica entries for those pieces. YouTube would pay, I guess, Britannica a fee, and Britannica would be able to say, well, if we get more of the advertising, people can see it, they can, you know, trial out our services. If they like what they see, they might subscribe, and on they go from there. So the future looks kind of bright. And it's not to say, you know, there isn't a place for Wikipedia. There was a nice comparison where even Wikipedia says of the 6 million articles they've got, they don't rate them all as being fantastic. They hold that there is a similar sort of number of well-researched, top-quality articles on Wikipedia as you would find in Encyclopedia Britannica. So these days, it's really good. Parents, go ahead and do it. And the other really impressive thing about, of course, in the 90s, getting somebody to pay for something online was damn near impossible. It's not easy now, but then it was very, very hard. And so the fact that they actually stuck with this subscription model, let's pay for this, rather than saying let's stick on ads and hope somebody wants to do some branded content, was a very shrewd move for them.
You know, and in this world of alt facts and fake news, ironically, it's playing so strongly back into the hands of Encyclopedia Britannica, which has kept the faith in terms of being loyal and true to that old-fashioned, facts, and presenting those in a digital format, in a paid-for format. So at least if you want your kids who can find anything via Google but you don't know if it's true, if you're subscribing and paying the $1,000, and I'm assuming you're talking about 1,000 South African rand, yes, access to this wealth of information, and it's information that can be updated. You don't buy this year's Encyclopedia Britannica to have stuff updated next year. This happens online. It's a stroke of genius because these guys now come full circle back to good old-fashioned fact-checking and truth.
Indeed, and I think they might be very happy if I were to say, rather than just leaving it as an entry, you have to go and inquire. They've actually started writing up some pieces, which they've got under a section called Demystified, which are the popular misconceptions, myths, things that are sort of spread around on social media to answer things. So if I were to ask you, would playing Mozart to unborn children help them be more creative in later life?
That is one of the greatest misconceptions, but do you dare not do it? No, of course, but you end up doing it. And because just in case.
Cover your odds. Well, yeah, that's
and besides, hey, Mozart's cool. So it's nice music. And if the child does get a benefit, that's a double whammy of joy and happiness, etc.
Indeed, but they do categorize.
It's rubbish, isn't it?
There's nothing to it. Play music because you like the music. That would it. And then into a question you asked a little earlier about the world's largest tire manufacturer, and you correctly pointed out it was Lego. I can add to you the information that 700 million tires are created by that Lego company. And so this is the second one we're looking at. They started in 1947 with the sort of brick making. It was a carpentry business before that, and they really have had a torrid time, actually. The early years were terrible. It was only when this carpenter went to go to a demonstration thing and saw this plastic extrusion machine, which surprisingly made little plastic bricks as a demonstration. They had no idea what this could be used for. They just figured, well, you know, we'll show you how you extrude things with little bricks. And the carpenter said, well, maybe there is something in this. And man, his timing was good because, of course, in the 50s, plastic was the futuristic material for everything. Europe and America were recovering from the wars. There was a lot more money being spent on children. And so those were their really big boom years. The 80s came along. It still wasn't looking bad, but those patents were about to run out. And of course, by then, everybody had thought, man, if, you know, make little plastic bricks, you've got a license to print money. And so they started becoming a little cautious. They started becoming a little wary. They said, let's diversify. They opened up theme parks and clothing lines. And they tried to invest in the computer games things in the 90s. Some of it wasn't bad. But when you start spreading yourselves a bit thin, you do run into a bit of trouble. And it rose to the point that after 2000, in fact, 2004, I think, was their lowest point, that the potential debt burden they have was looking to eclipse their actual revenues and sales. And they turned to a guy that had a really remarkable sort of relationship with Martin Lindstrom was his name. He was a 17-year-old and built this Lego set thing out in his backyard. And then he wanted to invite everybody to come and have a look at it. And initially, it was very poor, and his parents attended. So he got a local newspaper. He hassled a bit, and he got a local newspaper to cover it. And they ran an article to say, "Look at this great kid! Look what he's got! Come along and have a look." And the next week, he had like over 100 people come and have a look at his thing. And he thought, "Yes, I'm in business." Unfortunately, two of the people that arrived were lawyers from Lego, who said, "Oh, what do you think you're doing?" But they understood that this guy was onto something. He was a lover of Lego. And in his own studies, it sort of managed to stick with him. And Lego and most businesses, even now, still we entrust a lot of stuff into big data. We take these huge data sets of demographics about people and where they live and their habits and they're buying things. And they figured, right, this is what we do. And all of them were saying in the 90s, certainly, kids have got no time for spending a long time sticking little bricks together. They wanted instant gratification. They wanted something far more interactive and engaging. So they made the bricks bigger. They started trying to make video games and spread themselves all over the show. But he does a special kind of survey. He goes and actually visits people's homes and he just watch what they do. And on a particular visit, he noted an 11-year-old in Germany who had an old pair of shoes, which he said was the most proud thing he owned, because these shoes were worn out with a very specific pattern that only a dyed-in-the-wood skater would be using. So these shoes were worn in such a way that only other skaters would say, wow, you must skate a lot. And he took from that an insight that said, actually, if somebody loves Lego, they will spend a long time building something great than giving them an average thing with a meh product, which is not going to take so long. And they took the chance and they said, right, let's go back to the smaller blocks. Let's make even more intricate projects. They have 3,700 different types of bricks now. And they made the instruction manual. I'm pretty sure you've seen how big and how many pages there are in one of those things. And it worked. Getting more detailed was exactly the kind of thing that would help them. So they pulled out of all the other stuff. They did stick around with the movie franchises. That was particularly helpful for them. And that's how we kind of get to now. And it's not to say that they're out of the woods. Their sales last year have slumped a little bit. If 75 billion blocks can be considered a slump. And they are ultimately made out of plastic, which is no longer seen as the futuristic material, but they're busy testing out some made from sugarcane. But it is fair to say that they're over the hump, they're looking pretty good, and they're waiting for the next wave of disruption to come. And hopefully they're ready for it, because it's most likely going to be 3D printing. And I'm guessing if Lego is anything to go by, as they've done in the past, they will have your Lego Creator Studios come up with very elaborate designs, or designs that kids can go and evolve themselves, printed out and constructed. But for that, we'll have to wait and see.
Colin Cullis, what a fabulous insight. Thank you very much. Business Unusual.